Welcome to Lesson 9 in our study in the Book of Revelation as a part of the Prophecy Series. Today, we're going to continue on in our study in the second part of Revelation. If you remember, if we use Revelation chapter 1, verse 19, as a guide to understanding the book, we are in the part where John is told to write what is. And so that would be the letters to the seven churches. And so today, we're going to look at the sixth letter that was written from Jesus to the churches in Asia Minor. So today we're going to focus on Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 through 13, the letter to the church of Philadelphia. Now, again, I just want to remind you, I'm including a map of the area that is what is known as Asia Minor, or what we would know today of as Turkey. And in the area of Asia Minor, there is the Roman province of Asia. And that's where most of these seven churches are located. And so today we're going to be looking, if you notice the map, we're going to be looking to the south, again, of Sardis, is where Philadelphia is found. Now, as always, we're going to be following the same format with this letter as there has been with the other letters. So let's look at the first part. We're going to notice it in Revelation chapter 3, verse 7, the destination. Now, when we talk about the destination, we're going to divide it up into two sections. We're going to talk about who is receiving the letters, who are the recipients, and then we're going to see who the letter is from, which always is Jesus, but Jesus will describe himself in such a way that will have importance to the group that he is writing to. So let's start with by looking at the passage itself. When we think about the destination, let's focus in on verse 7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one shuts, who shuts and no one opens. Okay, so as we look at this, we're going to again see those two sections. We're going to focus, first of all, on the recipient. Who is it that this letter was intended for? And what I want you to notice is that Christ addressed the pastor of the church in Philadelphia. So this is, again, for the messenger. Again, messenger is that word that is translated in our English text, angel. It's the Greek word, angelos. And it could mean a human messenger or a heavenly messenger. With regards to this, it would make sense for it to be a human messenger. So therefore, it has to be the pastor or the elder. So he's addressing to the pastor of the church in Philadelphia. Now, let's talk about Philadelphia for the moment. Philadelphia, again, was an ancient Greek city that was established in 187 BC. It was the administrative district of Sardis. In AD 17, the city suffered badly in an earthquake, and the Roman Emperor Tiberius relieved it of having to pay taxes. In response, the city granted honors to Tiberius. The city experienced an additional 20 years of earthquakes. It was located in an area noted for agricultural products such as vine growing and wine production. Because of the wine production, Philadelphia became the center of the worship of Dionysus, the god of wine and fertility. So that's just kind of giving you a little bit of understanding of what's happening there with where this church was located in Philadelphia. Well, the next part of verse 7 is not just who it's for, but who's it from. And so I want to notice now the description of Christ. Now, there are several things that are pointed out here that you and I need to be aware of. So first of all, I want you to notice he identifies himself as holy and true. Holy and true. Now, that's going to be significant a little bit later when we get into the text. But what does that mean? He affirms his deity as holy and true. Now, when we talk about holy, we're talking about the aspect of being separated, of something other, of being separated to God, or God and His holiness. When we talk about true, we're talking about the standard of truth. Now, again, he makes point to talk about the reality that he holds the key of David. Now, that's the second part of the description, holds the key of David. Now, what in the world does he mean by that? Well, remember what I said, when we talk about having the keys, that talks about having authority. And we see that in the Old Testament, that those who had the keys in a kingdom had basically authority in that kingdom. Now, Christ proclaims his authority as the Son of David. So he is saying that he has the key of David. So therefore, he has the authority over what David has in his royalty. So that phrase, key of David, seems to refer to the key of the house of David that was given to Eliakim. It was the highest position in the royal court. The key allowed Eliakim to have access to all the wealth of the king. So Jesus is basically saying he has the key of David. He has access to everything that David had. Now, here's the third part of the description that we're going to see now. He who opens and shuts. Now, what is he referring to there? Well, Christ describes his actions as firm and no one can interfere. So if you think about what he's saying, he opens a door. Nobody can shut it. He is the one, when he does something, when he provides an opportunity or whatever, he is the one who's doing it. Nobody can contradict him. It's talking again about his power and authority. Now, the second part of the letters, if we've noticed, is when he commends them. So we're going to see the commendation here in chapter 3, verse 8. So I want you to notice now what the text says with regards to what Jesus is commending them for. So let's look at the text, verse 8. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Wow. In fact, think about it. What he's commending them for and what he's saying he's doing, it connects with what he describes about himself as the one who opens and no one shuts. Well, let's take a look at this. Several things we're going to point out here about what he's commending them for. So first of all, as with all of the other letters, we see in chapter 3, the first part of verse 8, Christ's knowledge of the church. So we're going to see that he has an understanding about them. So Christ has an intimate knowledge of the church. Now, he has said this about every single one of the churches. And that's something, again, for you and I to ponder. As we are a part of a local church, Jesus is very much aware of what's going on in his churches. More than just a knowledge of facts, he is intimately aware of what's going on in his churches. And he's intimately aware of what's going on in this church in Philadelphia. Now, when we come to chapter 3, verse 8, the second part, we're going to see their opportunity. Their opportunity. Now, what do you mean by opportunity, George? Well, Christ has set before them an opportunity for service. Notice in the text he says, I have set before you an open door that no one can shut. So he is basically saying, I have set before you an opportunity for you to do work, for you to serve, for you to serve me. Now, as he's mentioning that he has set that open door before them, that opportunity, in the third part of chapter 3, verse 8, he's going to acknowledge their condition. He's going to talk about where they're really at. What is their state with the reality of this open door? So I want you to notice, Christ notes that they had little power and resources. So even as he's saying, I've set before you this opportunity, he's saying, I also know that you have little power You don't have the strength to do this, and you don't have the resources. Okay, let's stop there for a moment. Because sometimes we think that we can only do things as a church or as an individual, we can only do things for the Lord if we have, number one, the money, the brain power, and the resources. Because if we don't have the money, the brain power, or the resources, we shouldn't even attempt it. He's saying, I've set before you, church at Philadelphia, an opportunity. Nobody can take this opportunity away from you. No one. And the reality is while I'm setting this opportunity before you, I'm very much aware that you are not strong enough, you have very little strength, and you have very little resources to do this, but I've still set this opportunity before you. Now, if you and I were really to think about that, that would make sense. Because when God calls us to do something, it's not that we need to have the resources and the ability and the brain power to do it. It's that a lot of times what he calls are people who can't do it, but he does it through them. And that's what we're seeing here with this passage. So again, when we look now at the fourth part of chapter 3, verse 8, we see their obedience. So even though they don't have enough strength to do it, they've got this opportunity before them, they're going to be obedient. So he commends them, Christ commends them for their consistent obedience. It's not just a one-time thing where they did what he's asking. They are being consistent in helping. They are being consistent in doing what he calls them to do. So man, what a church. What a church. Now, that brings us then what we're going to see in the other last part of chapter 3, verse 8, their endurance. So as they're doing this, he's going to talk about their endurance. So Christ commends them for not giving in to the pressure to deny Christ. He's commending them as they're doing, as he set this opportunity before them. They don't have enough resources. They don't have enough strength. But he commends them. He says to them, look, you are doing well because you're not giving in to the pressure to deny me. That is what is amazing. That is what's powerful about this church at Philadelphia. Now, as we've noticed with the other letters, there's a third part. And some of the other letters have experienced this, although there have been some who have not. Well, the third part is a rebuke. And if you're going to notice in this letter, well, here it is. It's notable that Christ did not rebuke them. So here, with the church at Philadelphia, he points out all of these things that he commends them for. He commends them for their service, their obedience. He commends them because they have this opportunity. And even with their little strength and resources, they are still doing it. But then when it comes to something that he's irritated with them about, something that he's displeased about, this church, he doesn't find anything. And I think this is, again, very significant. I think it's significant if he can't find anything good about a church. I think it's significant when he looks at a church and he says, I can't find anything wrong. And that's what's going on here with this third section of the letter. There is no rebuke. There is no rebuke. Well, that brings us then to chapter 3, verses 9 through 11. As with all of the other letters, it's the fourth section. Chapter 3, verses 9 through 11, the exhortation. So he's going to exhort them to do something. He's going to call them to act in a certain way or to respond in a certain way. And there are some wonderful truths here. So let's take a look at the text, starting with verse 9. Here is what John writes. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole earth to try those who dwell on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have, so that no one may seize your crown." Wow, a lot of truths here. So let's take a look at these three verses and ponder the things that are being shared in the exhortation. I think the first one, I think, is very powerful, even for you and I, would be powerful for them. We see it in chapter 3, verse 9, the acknowledgement of their enemies. The acknowledgement of their enemies. What do you mean, George? Well, he is exhorting them to hang in there because the people who are giving them problems, well, here's the point. Their enemies will acknowledge them and Christ's love for them. See, here's the thing, folks. You and I have enemies. We have enemies against the gospel and so forth. We have enemies who mock us about our faith, and they had enemies. We have enemies around the world against Christianity. And the promise is that in the future, when there is the judgment, and it's the great white throne judgment, when everyone will appear before Jesus, which we find in the last part of Revelation chapter 20, at that time, when the books are open and they have to give an account for their life, the enemies that we have, the enemies to our faith, will come and acknowledge us. They'll bow down to us. And they will acknowledge that Jesus loved us. Isn't that a powerful thought? Because sometimes we think, will anybody ever be held to account? Is it worth me hanging on? Is it worth me doing what Jesus says, where he says, "Vengeance is mine"? Is it worth it? Yes, because in reality, Christ is going to make sure that justice is served, and it's specifically for his children. Now, how do we know that? Well, when we look at Isaiah chapter 49, verses 22 to 23, I want you to notice what Isaiah says. Verse 22. "Thus says the Lord God, behold, I will lift up my hand to the nations and raise my signal to the peoples, and they shall bring their sons in their arms, and their daughters shall be carried on their shoulders. Kings shall be your foster fathers, and their queens your nursing mothers, and with their faces to the ground, they shall bow down to you and lick the dust of your feet. Then you will know that I am the Lord. Those who wait for me shall not be put to shame." Now, again, what we see here is just the Old Testament version of what was being said in Revelation, in that promise, in that exhortation to the church at Philadelphia, that their enemies will come and bow down to them. So here the prophet is saying to Israel, look, your enemies, they will come and they will serve you and they will acknowledge you and they will bow down and basically prostrate themselves before you. And when that happens, you will know that God is the Lord because he has brought justice. And he will not put us to shame, even though we've endured all of this stuff that we're going through now. Now, that's going to bring us to the second part of the exhortation. And I think this is a wonderful part that a lot of times I don't hear people talking about. I hear people talking about this issue, but they don't really focus in on this promise. And so when we come to chapter 3, verse 10, we see the promise of the rapture. The promise of the rapture? What are you talking about, George? Well, let's take a look. Let's go back to verse 10. And what we're going to see in verse 10 is, notice what he says, "Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth." So he's promising this church that, well, Christ promises that they will not have to endure the coming tribulation. That's what he's speaking of. They're not going to endure the coming tribulation. Now, let's take a couple of things so we understand what we're talking about. So when it talks about the hour of trial, The hour of trial refers to that future time of great tribulation that believers will be spared from. So it's going to be that seven-year period, which we're going to talk about in this study of Revelation as we get further into the book, but they're going to be kept from, the promise is that those believers and you and I are going to be kept from that hour of trial. Now, what does it mean by to keep from the hour of trial? While believers may face difficulty and suffering at the present time, they will certainly be protected from God's wrath in the great tribulation. This is the promise of the rapture of the church. And again, if you understand the rapture and what takes place with it, you just simply need to look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13. Now, with those two promises, that first of all, we see the exhortation that one day our enemies are going to come and bow down to us. We see the second exhortation that there's the promise given that if we endure, if we hang in there, we don't have to worry about going through that tribulational period. Now, there's a third part here to the exhortation. And again, it goes back to the encouragement to endure. We see that in chapter 3, verse 11. Now, what do you mean that by that, George? Well, Christ encourages them to persevere to the end. Listen, folks, that is the encouragement throughout the book of Revelation. It's throughout the scripture. Hang in there. Don't throw in the towel. To him who overcomes, I will do this. We are given promises if we endure. So again, they are encouraged to endure to the end. Well, then that brings us now to our final section of the letter, which is the promise. And we're going to see that in chapter 3, verse 12 through 13, the promise. Now, let's take a look at the text. Let's start with verse 12. The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Okay, so if we take this promise, we're going to see several things that come out of this, okay? First of all, when we look at chapter 3, verse 12, the first part, we're going to see that the issue of a pillar. We are described as we're going to be a pillar. Now, what in the world is he talking about? Well, a pillar is like a pillar on a temple. It's something permanent. So they will have, that is, you and I, believers, they will have a permanent place in heaven. So he's saying to this church, you know, if you overcome, if you endure, I'm going to make you a pillar and you will have a permanent place in heaven. What an awesome thing to be promised. Well, notice now when we look at the second part of verse 12, the names of God and the New Jerusalem. Now, what in the world are we talking about the names of God? Well, those names will be written on us. What do you mean written on us? Well, it basically means that we belong to God. They will belong to God. We'll belong to God because we'll have his name on us. We'll have the name of the New Jerusalem on us. So it's talking about possession, that he will possess us. We are his. Now, when we come to the third part of verse 12 in chapter 3, we see Christ's new name. So we won't just have the name of God the Father on us or of the new city, the New Jerusalem on us. We will also have Christ's name on us. And so that signifies that they will belong to Christ. That is, we will belong to Christ. We belong to him. We are his. And so it's a sense of possession. Kind of like, I think if you understand from farming, it's kind of like a farmer who brands his cattle with his mark saying, this is my cow. This is what we see here. Well, then that brings us to the last verse, which we have seen with each and every one of the letters. That is in verse 13 of chapter 3, the exhortation. So again, notice what's been said. It's again an exhortation for all who read it, for you and I. Here's what he says. We are called to acknowledge what the Holy Spirit reveals to us. We're called to acknowledge what God shows us. So as we have been going through this lesson, as you've been reading this letter for yourself, as God has spoken to you, either through the description of himself or what he commends them for and about the opportunity that is set before them and the reality that they have little strength and so forth, as God is speaking to you through that and then the reality of what he's exhorting them to the promise of the reality that they don't have to endure this, or that one day their enemies will come down and bow to them. And when you talk about the promise of what it's going to be like in the future when you overcome, God is speaking to you. You got to pay attention to that. You got to acknowledge that. You got to apply that to your life. And that is so true. This principle, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. That's true whenever we read the scripture. Well, that brings us to the end of the letter to the church at Philadelphia, this sixth letter. In our next lesson, we're going to look at the last letter, the final letter that Jesus wrote to these seven churches, and that will be the letter to the church at Laodicea.